السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. أنا منال الدباغ وأهلا وسهلا في بودكاست لنبدأ الحوار Start the Conversation. الهدف من البودكاست أنه نبدأ الحوار في مواضيع مختلفة ما أخذت حقها في مساحة الحوار أو ما في أحد يبغى يتكلم فيها. المواضيع مختلفة لكن كلها بتدور حول كيف نقدر نعيش بكليتنا مش كأجزاء متفرقة في تناغم مع الناس حوليننا والبيئة. الفضول والشغف هو اللي خلاني أبدأ البودكاست وهو اللي يدفعني لاختيار المواضيع وضيوف البودكاست. مرة تانية أهلا وسهلا وإن شاء الله تلاقوا شيء مفيد في الحلقة، وإذا في أي مواضيع تحبوا تسمعوها أو أشخاص تحبوا تسمعوا منهم أتواصلوا معايا. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. لقاء اليوم باللغة الإنجليزية معايا بول ليندن، معلم ومدرب Being in Movement، Aikido teacher، Feldenkrais practitioner. في الحلقة حنتكلم على الوعي الجسدي وكيف لما إحنا نكون في حالة من الاسترخاء الانبساط والحب بنكون فعالين أكثر وقادرين إنه نتخذ قرارات أفضل، نكون أفضل ما عندنا. أتمنى إنه حواري مع بول يعجبكم. هو أحد من أكبر الإنفلونس والمؤثرين في العمل اللي أنا بعمله، وإذا في أي سؤال عن بول عن أو أي شيء ذكر في الحلقة أتواصل معايا. شكرا. Welcome everyone to another episode of the podcast Start the Conversation. With me today is Paul Linden. Paul is a specialist in body and movement awareness education, Feldenkrais method practitioner, sixth Dan black belt degree Aikido in Aikido, and developer of Being in Movement, and one of my teachers who I've learned so much, and I No, I've only scratched the surface in learning from you. Paul, it's an honor to have this conversation with you. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be here with you.
Okay, so where would you like to start, Paul?
Well, let me think. Let's start with something practical. My feeling is if I'm going to talk for 60 minutes, people ought to learn something they can use. So let's start with something fairly simple. And if your listeners don't want to do this, they don't have to, of course. Mm-hmm. Think of any word, one word that is connected to a very terrible experience in your life. Cancer, rape, virus, something that you really don't want at all. And then I would ask, what happens in your body? And more to the point, what are you doing in your body when you say those words? Is there any response at all?
For me, it's constriction of breathing, tension in my shoulders. It's like kind of a closed up sense.
Create a wall to keep it out. Mm-hmm. That's what we all do. That's what we're built for, but it doesn't work well. One of the things that's very obvious, if I say take a defensive stance, feel defensive, most people cross their arms or get small and tight in some way. And the fact is that I can test that for them. It isn't my opinion. But when they're like this, I can poke them wherever I want and they can't respond. When they're wide open, they can stop me from doing any poking. And they experience that the more vulnerable they feel, the less penetrable they are. Their defenses are better when they're open. And the extreme of this, I had one client who was firmly convinced that if she closed her eyes when she was driving on the freeway, nobody else could see her. And so she couldn't get hit. That's a little non-functional, but that's the way we're built. We close up, and then we feel that we're safe. In fact, by opening up, we can see and feel and think, and then we're safer. So that you can apply in any situation. If you let your tongue hang loose, if you let your chest hang loose, let your belly hang loose, let your arms hang loose, and then say the word again. What does that do?
It's just a word.
Yes, it always was just a word. We add the discomfort to the word. I should mention, I imagine, that I have Parkinson's. I've had it for 15 years. I don't know that many people can function after 15 years, but I'm still functioning. I think it's the body awareness material that enables me to do what I'm doing now. But if you use the body as a place to discover what you're doing and feeling and thinking, you can then use a technology, so to speak, to change the body's natural responses. We can do better than we're built for.
Well, since you mentioned Parkinson's, and I talked to you about to anyone who would listen about this guy who has Parkinson, and he had made peace with it. And you can correct me if I'm not using the correct word. And I've heard you speak about it briefly, but I'm interested to know more about your own process of having been diagnosed 15 years ago, and how is it right now? And I'm sure it's a long process. It's not a, you know,
15 years worth of process. And that's okay. 35 years of Aikido before that, that got me ready for the 15 years. Basically what I've done, you cannot stop a feeling or a behavior. It's like digging a hole in the water, but you can put something else in place of the water. And so what I did when I was first diagnosed, my practice for about 6 months was to say, Parkinson's, not Parkinson's, oh my God, Parkinson's. First when I do that, the tremors die down. So I spent a long time doing that, 6 months or a year. And then I basically took the unease out of the disease. So I can do things. I don't feel that I'm losing or that I'm prosecuted or persecuted by my body. It's just what it is. And I'm not trying to fight the Parkinson's. I'm trying to establish a sense of peace and strength. Let me see how I am this morning. It's fairly early over here. Let me see. I'm standing on one foot. I couldn't do that 6 months ago. I'm slowly recovering my movement by being able to understand the intentional basis of the movement, how you create movement in your body. So it's a hobby. It's not a hobby I would have chosen. It is a hobby, and I keep learning from it.
So if I understand this correctly, your initial response was like, oh, this is that. That's, I think that's everyone's normal reaction to any kind of disease.
Right, of course.
And through the training or through the establishing the ease in just saying the word, that started the process of you making peace with Parkinson. Is that correct?
Yes. I think of emotions, feelings as, well, I distinguish between the two, so I have two different words. Emotions are actions you do in your body. Anger, confusion, resignation, fear. They're all things we do in our body. And if you pay attention to your body, you can choose which emotions you will work with. I'm not saying you have to stuff your emotions or anything like that, but there is a time and a place. As a martial artist, I've got black belts in karate and aikido. You don't say to the person on the street, wait a minute, man, I got to get in touch with my inner warrior. I'm not quite ready to defend myself. Give me 10 minutes, please. If you can pull that off, you're a great martial artist. But you have to know how to center yourself and be calm and strong and kind-hearted when the stuff hits the fan. You do it when it's needed, and you don't do some of the natural things because they get in the way. So I'm not against emotions, but I am saying you have to have some kind of self-regulation, or you can go off the deep end.
With that, noticing the emotion, noticing what you are doing in your body at that point, and working with that, that is what establishes the ease.
Well, that is how you establish anything you're working towards. Unless you're, if you don't want ease, if you want to win the martial arts tournament, you can do the same process in a very destructive way in your body and mind. But I think that if you use the process and search for ease and comfort, I think that is a way to achieve it. It's not philosophy, it's physiology.
It's one of the things that fascinated me about Aikido in general and your work is this. It seems to me now I'm learning this for the past 5 or so years, and it seems like intuitive, but I know it's kind of culturally and counterintuitive, is that coming from a place of ease, openness, and expansiveness is, if I could say, an ideal state to do anything we choose to do. Can you explain this to our listeners?
Yes. What people do when they're challenged, threatened, hurt, when they feel powerless because they don't have the power, the resources to do something that's important. I made up the word we smallify. I can't think of an English word which means get smaller without being either small and loose, small and tight, small and angry. There's a smallifying of every kind of thinking and feeling we do when we're challenged or threatened or hurt. And that constrains our behavior, our responses to more violence, more aggression. So if you're pushed on, the natural response is push back. If I grabbed your hand, now you've probably seen this, so you're not the ideal audience, but if I grabbed your hand and said, don't let me pull you toward me, what would you do? You'll pull back, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's another one. I'll finish this one first. If I walk toward you faster than you're pulling, am I fighting you? No. I'm just making use of your power to achieve the suggestion. I said, don't let me pull you toward me. And if you walk faster than I'm pulling, I'm not pulling. I can't. You'll be in charge of the movement. Let's say you've got two people. Your arms are outstretched. You've got one person on one arm, one person on the other, and they're pulling you, trying to get you half or something like that. The person who gets the bigger piece can make a wish, of course. What do you do against two enemies? How would you deal with that?
The natural response, I don't know. You tell me.
Okay. Most people pull back on both of them. The idea response, hey, let's you and me pull on him. See what I mean? It's a different way of thinking. It's find the cooperative, find the aware and alert and soft response, and that will also be the powerful response. One of the things that I use as a sort of slogan, power without love is brutality. Love without power is ineffective.
I had that one of the topics or points I want to discuss even more, because this sentence, I could spend years just breaking it down.
Years breaking it down. That's how I got there. It took me years to understand what that meant and to explain.
Walk me through that process to help me and anyone else, because it's very simple and precise and it makes sense. It's just, how do we get there?
Okay. If you weren't so bloody stupid, you'd be able to do this on your own. What do you feel when I say something like that? What do you do in your body?
Well, I did what I did do in my body is I was laughing because, you know, I know your pulse. So, but I would imagine if you have done this, I would pull back, I would constrict, and I would feel more aggressive.
Yes, that's the normal response. You have too many noses. If I get up to explain people, let me see if I can do this. If I throw tissue at the screen, what do you do? Anything?
Oh, yeah. I closed my eyes and I pulled back. Although this is a tissue throwing practice I've done so many times.
And I couldn't, with the worst will in the world, hurt you with a tissue from this distance.
Mm-hmm.
Tissues don't go that far. Intercontinental ballistic tissue. And that to hurt you. But that is fear, anger, fight, flight, freeze, or collapse. Those are the four, probably more, but in any case, what we do is we smallify. Mm-hmm. So I'm a pointillist. I love a million points of data, but that's too much. So I've developed a much simpler, faster way of getting at the five things that have been the core practice for me. So first, relax your tongue, relax your jaw, relax your throat. Relax your chest and belly, relax your pelvic floor, relax your legs. The whole core of the body, just let it hang. Let it be soft. How does that feel?
It feels really nice. And
so relaxation is the first part of replacing smallifying, but it's not the end. Okay, so can you think of something that makes your heart smile? Mm-hmm. Something that you love and makes you feel good? What changes in your body when you do that?
Expansion of becoming bigger of some sort or connected.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. A third one Have you ever been a firefly's butt? I don't know if you have fireflies where you live.
No, I haven't ever been one, but I know what the firefly is. So it's the bug that lights up in the dark. Yeah.
Or you could be a light bulb or a star. Anything which gives you a concrete feeling of radiating outwards. So that the first two, the relaxing the core and the heartfelt friendliness or kindness, they're about inside of you. The next one is about bridging to the outside. Can you take that relaxation and that love and shine it outwards? In any metaphor you wish, just open like a firefly's butt or like a light bulb or something. And most people will experience that they are now in connection with the person that they're dealing with as an opponent or something of the sort, but they're not against them. They're with them, and that opens the possibility of finding some productive solutions. Instead of you hit me, I'll hit you back, and it keeps going. The last two exercises that I've used have to do with the pelvis as the stable center of posture. And let me see. I think your listeners could do this if you want. If you stand up, put your fingers on your hips. Now, I don't know every language in the world, but in English, there's no word for the hip, no common word for the hip joint. You have to use anatomical terminology. The hip bone is here. The hip joint is where the leg folds when you lift the knee forward. So put your fingers in your hip joints, if that's a good word, and push your tail down to the chair so you're sitting. Go back and then stay there. How does that feel?
It feels a stronger sit.
Yes, it is for most people. Mm-hmm. And is it a physical or mental thing that you've just done?
Physical.
No, it isn't. Yes, it is.
It's both.
It's not both. It's one. Mm. My favorite joke is, what's the difference between a duck? And the answer is that both legs are shorter than both of the other ones. Doesn't make much sense. But when I hear people say it's psychological or physical, or it's both, I don't find that there's two things. There's one thing, me. And if I speak one language, that's about language of feelings, thoughts. And if I speak a different kind of language, it's about the body. But there's only one person there. You can speak a language. You can say, I feel very comfortable doing lectures because I love the people I talk to. Or you can say, when I do a lecture, my chest softens, my throat opens up, my legs are more stable. It's a little cumbersome to speak about emotions that way, but it's really helpful if you're trying to figure out what you're feeling. And it's imprecise if you speak about your body saying, let your shoulder enjoy ice cream. You can say that, but it's a little easier to say, let the shoulder relax and let the joint open up. See what I mean? So there are different kinds of languaging that we can use most efficiently for certain topics, but that doesn't mean that those languages are separate. If I say, setten chaise, das ist ein Stuhl, that's a chair. Three languages, but there's only one chair.
Yeah, I always love their precision in speaking and which words to use. And I found it personally, the difference between my shoulders are tense or I'm tensing.
My shoulders, right.
I am tensing my shoulders. And I think it's quite... So how do we speak about everything at the same as one? If I'm feeling...
It's too complicated. Languages, but I find for myself, if I'm helping somebody start the process, the physical language is much more precise and much easier for people to get. Very strange, but it's easier.
How strange? Because for some people, it seems, and I know, you know, the language is really a big part of your method of teaching. So what example of something that does not make sense physically, or we can't teach people in that way?
Okay, I suppose you probably could. It's not that it's wrong or doesn't work well, absolutely. my style and my teaching come from what I needed to hear when I was a baby learner. I find it far more precise to say, well, somebody says I'm sad. I say, really, where? And that sounds weird. Where in your body are you doing sadness? Now, I don't relate on this level to everybody I meet. They don't want to. They say, how are you this morning? I say, I'm fine. How are you? And we go about our business. If I went into, oh, how are you? That would be too intrusive and too much time taken off. But it's very handy to have this language, this concreteness of language, because you can test things. For example, I often get people coming into me to work with me who say, my yoga teacher said I should breathe this way. And I say, why? What for? What's the purpose? This is the right way to breathe. Right for what? For whom? For what outcomes? And it turns out that if you do the opposite of what some people think is right, there's more room for different kinds of rightness. And it may be that in yoga class, they breathe this way for a purpose. And in my class, it may have a different purpose. So you can't just say what's the right way, for whom, for what, in what context. And if you start thinking and speaking that way, it's testable. If I say, breathe this way, it will help you throw the basketball or give a public speech, and you try it and it doesn't, then I'm wrong. You go find somebody else who can tell you something that will be useful. But if you test, you don't automatically believe the authority. You test what the authority says. When I work with people, I often will tell them I'm going to lie to them. And if they don't catch me on it and say, you're not telling the truth, that isn't right, then I'm going to be really intrusive and say, didn't you know I was saying something dumb? Why didn't you catch me on it? Because I'm not perfect. I was once for 3 seconds, but after that. But testing is a very crucial part of my work. You don't just assume that when I say it works, you try it. And if it doesn't work, then I've learned something by your testing it. And if it does work, then you've learned something.
And I think that brings it to the importance of using it on a physical level and something that it's, as you said, testable and tangible. So I can sense my feet is doing this way, well, or I'm doing this with my feet. And instead of making it a mental construct that we could be, you know, five people could be talking about what seems to be the same thing, but everyone has their own interpretation of what that really means.
Exactly. A very interesting exercise is to have somebody stand in the middle of the room, and however many people you've got in the class, each person walks up and gives that person in the middle a pebble, lovingly. And you'll see so many different interpretations of what it means to approach somebody lovingly and give them something, or angrily. Another similar exercise, if you walk around and watch the people and tell the people in the class to watch you, and they will see something, then you ask them to get angry and watch you. And almost always they will report that I look different, that I have changed, I'm more harsh in my movements. But I haven't changed anything. They have put anger into their eyes, and so they see differently.
Yeah, that's one of the most profound things for me in becoming aware of what I am doing, because an understanding what I am doing with my own body kind of puts me in that certain perspective of what I'm doing. So if I'm constructed and I'm tense, that's essentially the lens I'm looking at. I want to go back to, you mentioned when you were talking about the tissue throwing, and that's one of the, I think, the biggest learnings that I'm really being conscious of is calibration of, you know, using the tissues, which seems very silly, and it's not, it doesn't make any sense, but it's, there's a really good reason behind using tissues to calibrate. Could you speak about that? And how did you come up with the tissues?
Well, I've been practicing Aikido for 50 years. I had about 10 years of karate in the middle of it because I wanted to learn both languages, hard and soft. And there is no learning unless somebody's attacking you. Now, I often get into interesting discussions with Aikidos who say, I'm your partner. Together, we will create flow and harmony. And that's true, but it's not my partner that I have to deal with. It's my enemies that I have to be kind, respectful, strong, and deal with them that way. So I'm used to people punching hard and fast at me. I am after 50 years, but most people don't have 50 years to wait. So what I found was if I create an analog of the ordinary martial arts situation, attack, defense, with a tissue, hardly anybody is overwhelmed by a tissue. And it's the same when I raise my arm this way. Do you have any response at all?
No.
Many people have a response, especially if they've been hurt as children. They will respond to the gesture. And even if I'm throwing a tissue at the screen 1,000 miles away from them, it still is a real attack for them. So what I do is I try to introduce the idea of calibration. If this is too much, if you don't want to do it, you certainly don't have to. And I'll go through a bunch of things. Is this too much when I throw the tissue at you? Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, I get people for whom it is not too much. Military people, et cetera, et cetera. One of my cute little tricks, I'll take a box of Kleenex, pretend to throw it at them, and whip my hand for it, but let go of the box so it just falls on the floor at my feet. So that's very safe. But they don't scope it out. They see me about to throw an object at them, and that will raise the energy, so to speak. But most people need calibration downward. You need something less, smaller, easier to deal with. And then we can gradually work our way up to the full attack, whatever it was that they experienced.
And can you explain more on why that is important to do, the calibration?
Because if you push people into the deep end of the swimming pool who do not know how to swim, they'll drown. So if I say, okay, you tell me that you were abducted by a giant green space bunny and he bit you on the nose, let's do that right now. Now, the reason I use such a silly example, I'm virtually certain there's nobody on this earth who has ever been attacked by a giant green space bunny. So I can use that as an example without triggering somebody. But if I accidentally step in what was real for them, they could get very triggered, and I haven't taught them yet how to manage the trigger. So I start with something trivial and small and unthreatening as a place to do the work. Once they have learned that I'm fairly trustworthy and fairly skilled, then they will allow me to go a little farther. If we stop before, I think your question is also, why do I go all the way into the fight, into what happened? Because if you don't, you haven't won. If you've fallen in the water and don't know how to swim, you can do all kinds of work about fear of water and making friends with water, et cetera, et cetera. But if you can't swim, you haven't finished. And people who, this comes in with the territory of being a martial artist. There's one very well-known person who's done some body-oriented therapy. And his comment once was, what defeated the victim will defeat them again. You have to use metaphor to help them heal. And I think metaphor is a good way to start. If you've been hurt by a human being, you have to know how to protect yourself against that same hurt in case somebody else tries it. And not so much in case somebody else tries it, but in order to feel safe and free, you have to be able to deal with it. I had one client who, her father, whenever she got upset, whenever she did anything he didn't like, would knock her unconscious and rape her. She had to go back to her father's house to get something. He tried to strangle her again. She did the parry that I taught her. She spun him around, threw him up against the wall and said, you can't do that to me anymore. Now, I wouldn't recommend that you go searching for your perpetrator, but in that instance, it was so clear. She felt like the whole world had been lifted off her shoulders because he couldn't do it again.
Yeah, but, and you do work with a lot of trauma.
Yes.
I don't know, it's the correct way of saying it, survivors. That's the correct way of saying it. Okay. But it's not necessarily how you start working with them by throwing them at the deep end of the water. That the calibration is to give them that space where they can have something small and they can work their way up to that.
And it takes as long as it takes. I constantly tell people, don't do as much as you can. Do a little less. Give yourself a break and go safely and slowly.
And I think that's going slow is also counterculture. Although now we are in times where we're forced to be slow and, you know, we can't, there's a lot of things that we can't do and we're staying at home. There's no traveling and all these things. Yeah. So we have to take things slow. We cannot be busy, although some people can stay busy, even if they're on their own.
Or they can stay agitated about not being. I've seen a number of people who get upset about not being able to relax. And don't bother relaxing if it gets you upset to try.
So how do you work with someone who is upset that they can't relax?
I throw a tissue at them. Or I might I do something which they have to react to, and then I show them how they can. I start small, and if somebody's too upset about something to relax, I don't tell them relax, because I could say it in a million different languages. If they don't know how to do it, it won't help. So I think that one of the things you have to do is match your language to the language of your client. And it doesn't mean just I speak English, you speak English. It's the details. It's the flow that you have to match. And you start where they're capable of starting. Because if you start where they're not capable of starting, they won't be capable of it.
And for those of us who this is completely a new thing of speaking the same language, because I've seen, and I've been guilty of it myself when I first started learning something, is doing it the way I've been taught. And that's how I teach it or I do it. How do we grow the skill of matching this language with the client, whoever that what might be, or, you know, even people in around us? How do we start building that skill?
You keep looking for concreteness and testability. I'll give you an example. A woman that, with whom I've been working for a while, came in one day and she said, I've been starting to take yoga classes and I'm trying to stop making judgments. So I pulled a knife on her and she said, I said, no, that's a judgment. And she got it. It's judgmentalness or prejudice that you want to stop. But if you stop judgments, you walk on the red instead of the green, you get squashed by a truck. So I think you have to stick with concrete terms and testable terms. And then you can gradually teach people to think differently and be aware differently.
We're not suggesting anyone pulls a knife onto any clients. Let's make this one clear.
I agree, but I'm a martial artist. I teach people how to protect themselves against baseball bats, knives, whatever. That's well within my job description.
I don't know how many martial artists will be listening to this, but it's, so it's finding the concrete and testable thing and having some kind of a stressor or something that gets a reaction that is noticeable.
Yes. It's got to be real enough to have an actual reaction, but so minimal that the person isn't scared off by it. They're interested and they learn how to control things. When I work with children, I start off with Dr. Linden's glorious anti-tickle technique. I can take almost any child in 5 minutes, teach them not to be ticklish, or any grown-up for that matter. And that is amazing to them. And once I've caught them and shown that I can teach them something that they would find useful and interesting, then we're off and running. I can teach them lots of stuff after that.
So with centering and breathing, that would be your anti-tickling technique.
Exactly.
And does, you know, I'm assuming it works with kids, so I haven't linked it with tickling. I'm going to test that myself. After. No, I'm not.
That's too bad. You can do it from here.
I do know some people who would kind of get a response from just kind of the idea of someone tickling them.
Exactly. That gets to the topic of pain. Most of us create most of the pain we experience because we're afraid that we're going to experience some pain. I've had crowns put on my teeth. I've had various procedures done without anesthesia because I don't like the feeling of the anesthesia. And it's not a problem. Where most people, I gather from what the dentist has said, most people at that point where I'm feeling, okay, let's relax, let's let it go. Most people at that point are, oh my God, it hurts. And when you, it's very easy to demonstrate by pressing into a nerve point or something soft part of the body, that if you tighten up and resist the pain, it hurts much worse. If you just relax and let it happen, it doesn't hurt nearly as bad as we usually think it does.
And that, along with you having Parkinson's, so on the dentist chair with no anesthesia and everything is fine, and that's the 50 years of practice.
Yeah, I can still the tremor.
Yeah.
Little tremor, but I don't like to give the dentist a moving target. So I've learned how to still the tremors long enough for the dentist to do what they do. They drill, their drills are this big, and sometimes they point out the bottom of my feet if they drill too far, but it's not really a problem.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, of someone who's listening to this in the first, you know, for the first time. What does it mean that we are creating our, not creating our own pain, but because we're focusing on the pain, we're feeling it more?
It isn't just that we're feeling it more. It really does hurt a lot more. And if you tense a part of the body, it won't be as easy to choose not to be tense. That almost sounds intelligent. If you don't tense, you won't tense. But it turns out that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you go into the experience believing that it will hurt a lot, you'll amplify the hurt. Now, that's a very interesting thought you raise. Does it really change the amount of pain, or does it change how you're looking at the pain and that makes it seem like there's more? I hadn't thought about that exactly. I don't offhand know how I would separate the two. Whichever, it does work. If you just relax, it doesn't hurt as much.
And that's the end result, is it feels better. And that's what we're getting at. I've learned if I bumped my toe on the chair or kind of hurt myself in some ways, breathing through that, it does make it feel better. Or at least I can, you know, gather my wits and what do I need to do instead of just freaking out.
Most people have been taught to freak out.
What do you think the reasoning behind that, or where did it come from or originated from, this, that when we're tense, that's our reaction. We're tensing and, you know, more powerful if we're aggressive.
I suppose if you're walking through the jungle and your ancestors for 100,000 years have walked through the jungle, and your descendants are going to walk through the jungle for 100,000 years until our technological civilization comes along, I suppose it's a coping strategy. If you get angry, you can fight. If you freeze, well, many animals won't eat dead meat. If you're dissociated and not even present, that's very good, because if you're going to get eaten by a tiger, I don't want to be there and present as part of his lunch. Mm. He's going to eat me. I'd just as soon be somewhere else thinking about something else. So I guess there's some form of coping strategy. You are stronger when you're angry, but you're much less strong than if you were calm and kind and grounded. So it takes almost no effort to get to be angry and to put up as good a fight as you can when you're angry. It takes quite a bit of study to not be angry and to derive your power for fighting back from softness and kindness. It can be done, but it takes a while.
It does. And why kindness? Because you speak a lot about kindness. And to me, you know, of everyone I've met or didn't meet alive, the embodiment of kindness is, you come to my mind. It's that softness. But why kindness matter? Because being kind is not something that I hear a lot of people talk about.
and we get the kind of world we've got. Let's try something, if you will, please. Stand up, please.
Okay.
Stand on one foot and say something angry or unfriendly to me.
Your sweater is ugly.
Okay. What happens to your balance? Yeah, you're shifting.
I'm shifting, rocking, yes.
Say something friendly.
Oh, I really like you.
What happened?
The shifting way less.
Want to hit somebody hard, you have to be kind and friendly toward them, or your body will shake. It's not quite as well as I shake, of course, but it will shake a bit. And that's the answer. It's not a philosophical answer. Your body doesn't work well unless you're kind and aware and calm and compassionate and powerful. They all are together.
You speak about the same thing as ethics and, you know, kind of, as something that we do and we can test it.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, ethics, how could we test it? How we can make it testable and see?
I'll tell you a story. I was sent a 16-year-old kid to work with, and he was sent by a judge downtown that I didn't even knew of my work. But the kid came in, and I said, what do you want to learn? What are you here for, kid? He said, well, I don't know, but the judge sent me here because I'm always in fights, and I don't really feel happy and calm and strong unless I've got somebody down on the ground and I'm kicking him in the head. So I imagine he was waiting for me to say, that's not good. You shouldn't do that. What I said was, show me your kick. And he did. And I said, that's no kick. I can teach you to kick harder with much less effort. And he looked at me like I was crazy. Probably. But I did teach it to him. And he was willing to go in that direction and learn it because I showed him that if he relaxed and felt kind and all the rest of the stuff, then he was more stable and more capable of having a strong kick. One of the things I taught him was how to practice compassion and kindness. And he at first didn't want to, but then he did experience that it produced a better kick. I sort of forgot to tell him that by the time he was able to use kindness to produce a better kick, he wouldn't want to kick anybody. And that's pretty much what happened. If I told him that in the beginning, he would have walked away. I sort of conveniently forgot to tell him.
So it becomes a physical sensation, being kind, being respectful, being whatever it is, the quality that, you know, ethics would, being nice, simply as being nice. It becomes a physical sensation that we could...
become a physical sensation. It is from the very start a physical action in your body, but most people don't notice that and they don't know how to do it on purpose. If they're not feeling kind, they don't know how to trick the body into being kind.
Can you explain that a little bit?
If you weren't so bloody stupid, you'd understand. In any normal discussion, yeah. If somebody said that to you.
The reaction, I would, you know, find something, you know, to say back to you.
Okay.
You didn't explain it well enough.
Right.
For example.
Okay, so let me try again. I had a client who was sent to me by a therapist because she had been hurt as a child, and the therapist was stuck on trying to get this woman to forgive the guy. And she was clear, it wasn't for his purpose, it's for the sake of the woman who is trying to heal. But she said, I can't be kind toward the son of a bitch. You know what he did to me? I said, let's go out on the mat. That's where we practice. And I gave her a 4-foot stick. It's a staff weapon. I said, I'll hold up my staff. You hold up yours. Now hit my staff as hard as you can in a spirit of anger and revenge. And she did. And that was pretty good. And I said, may I hit your staff? And I did. And I cracked it in half. And she said, if love will let me hit that son of a bitch that hard, I'll love him. It's not a philosophical point of view. It works better. And I can show people in some activity or another that what they want doesn't lie in that direction, lies in the other direction.
And that's taking me back to love and power.
Yeah.
And then, you know, having a loving power and power and love. And it's essentially the same thing. Is that?
Yes.
So how do we get start to getting in terms with this love and power? Because both have been, you know, we have the shadow side of both, you know, being loving, being okay with anything and not standing up for yourself versus and being powerful that is aggressive and brutal and, you know, destructive. Well, how do we start to hear, you know, kind of bring those together?
Those, you're using the words in the way they're normally used. I am a word freak. And I like to be precise. And one of the things that I've realized is it's very hard to use the same word for two radically different things and know which one you're meaning. So I reserve the word power for what I call kind-hearted ethical strength. I wouldn't say power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's a phrase that people often use. I would say that the search for power is a search for purification of your intentions and your thoughts and purification of your actions. Searching for power is the search for being comfortable and kind and supportive and capable. So the part of the problem is language. But having said that, your question is, when somebody slaps me, this is what I do. It's a reflex. We get angry or we get afraid. Mm-hmm. How do you start changing that? By throwing tissues at you. Mm-hmm. Teaching you to notice what you do in your body. So it becomes a question of, and as you walk down the street, what are you doing in your body? And then you practice. And if you put one piece of paper down on a table, there's hardly any thickness there. But if you put one piece of paper down each day for a year, at the end of the year, you're going to have a fairly thick stack of paper, but there was no obvious thickening that happened all at once. So it's a slow process.
That's one of the clearest, at least to me right now, metaphors of practice. Could you repeat your definition of power?
Yes. I define power as the ability to control what's happening in your body and around you. To secure your comfort, your needs, your ability to live.
How about love? How do you define that?
Okay. Once when my son was little, he asked, he was about five, he said, how does a parent love a child? Or words to that effect. And I said, let's imagine that you and mommy and I were out boating and the boat tipped over. I'm an excellent swimmer and you couldn't swim and mommy couldn't swim. Who do you think I would save first? He said, you'd save me. I said, right. And who do you think mommy would want me to save first? Me. I said, that's how a child is loved by a parent. And the definition physically is, if I can walk up to you and say, you have too many noses, or something equally dumb, and your response is letting go, opening yourself, and thinking of something that makes you smile, that's a way of transferring the feeling from another situation, a better one, into this situation. Mm-hmm. I can look at a spot on the wall and be very friendly and kind toward it. I don't worry about wasting time. If people are forever saying, I'm sorry you had to wait online so long. Not a problem. I take my time. It's a time during the day when I can rest and not do much. So 5 minutes online is fine. Don't worry. But you pick something and you let yourself be soft and open physically.
Wow, we're heading to the end of the hour. And I'd like to speak a little bit about being in movement as a phrase, being in movement. What do you mean by that? And what is the practice?
All of the things that I've described here are the practice. Okay. What do I mean by it? Well, a human being is one meaning of it, in and movement. If I am in my movement and I'm aware of it, then that's what I'm trying to achieve. So human being or a quality of beingness, this is beginning to get a little philosophical for my tastes. I must have been philosophically inclined or I wouldn't have come up with that name for it. But it's the way of studying the body and studying the body as the self. Now, my website has a lot of free papers on everything from pregnancy to golf, etc., to conflict resolution and trauma recovery. And I've got a number of books. There is one book that's about 40 pages. It's called Reach Out. It's a free book. It's you can take it and reproduce it and give it away to your friends. That was my first attempt at simplifying what I'm doing. But it wasn't simple enough yet. So in the last few years, I found a way to get it down to 7 pages with 5 exercises. And those 5 exercises are the core of everything I've done for 50 years. And I'm finding that people can use it without contacting me, without having to be in my classes. They can get the stuff. I recently did a class on peacemaking for some folks maybe 2,000 miles away from me in a totally different cultural base. And they could take the handout and just teach it to their friends. So that made me especially pleased that I've come up with something which is not culture-bound, and it's so simple that anybody can, almost anybody can use it. It's called Embodied Peacemaking. So if you go to my website, it's available for free.
I'll have the website in the episode notes. And because when we were corresponding to talk about recording this episode, you asked me about the cultural piece. And my first response, and even now, is like, I don't see any kind of conflict or any different way of understanding, because it's very, very simple and testable. And yes, I say simple, but I've been listening to these 5 simple exercises for the last 3 years, and I'm just starting to grasp them in my own body. So simple, yet not so simple. Simple in words, maybe, yeah. But it needs practice. A word on practice before we end this.
Anything worth doing is you have to practice. I don't know why, but it's hard to do the good things. The bad things, you don't need to practice. They come very naturally. So practice is to have a technique and a context, and to keep repeating the context and the technique with variations until you're able to control what is happening inside of you and outside of you, and keep it calm and friendly and strong, as I might wish. That's what practice is. It's taking the time to become what you wish to be.
Your testament of practice.
Yes,
at least to me, 50 years of practice, it doesn't come easy. And in the beginning of this, you were standing on 1 foot. Is that your learning edge right now?
Parkinson's, yes. It offers me marvelous opportunities. It's an attacker that I always carry with me. I don't have to go to a martial art class to find the attacker. It's right in here. And I have recently been brought back my ability to skip and stand on 1 foot. I couldn't skip for the longest time. I'm sure in another 20 years of constant work, I won't tremor at all. That's a dark joke. If I have another 20 years, I probably won't tremor, but if I don't have another 20 years, then I certainly won't tremor.
And that's practice, those, you know, the five simple exercises over and over. And
there's an awful lot more that I didn't put into those 5 simple exercises.
Yeah.
I've spent hours practicing awareness of directions, et cetera, et cetera. My first book on trauma recovery was 440 pages. My next book on Aikido is about 300 some odd. When I started being interested in the Alexander technique years ago, I looked around. I found a 300-page book by a physician who was an Alexander practitioner, and I read it, and that convinced me it was worth pursuing. I like details and lots of them. That's how I learn and think. But most people don't need the details, and so they can do it much more quickly than especially if I've given them a roadmap.
Can we end this with a practice, whatever inspires you right now?
Well, let me think. Coronavirus. Now, what did you do in your body when I said that?
That's a lot of tension.
You can't keep the coronavirus from coming at you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No.
But
it's exhausting.
It is.
It is exhausting.
If you're exhausted enough, it'll make it easier for the virus to get in, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a practice. There's the right way to do things, and every other technique of meditation, et cetera, is wrong. You shouldn't do it. What do you hear when, what do you do in your body when you hear that crap?
I clenched my teeth.
Why?
Because that's absolutely not correct. Don't tell me what I have to do. That's my physical reaction. Yeah,
I agree with
personal
you.
Reaction.
Is that how you would choose to react? Is it as efficient and capable as you choose to be?
Absolutely not.
Okay, well, how do you get more efficient, more capable? Soft and open and feel the love and the power. And yeah, it's not easy. It's difficult and it's hard. And moreover, it's not easy.
Mm-hmm. Paul, it's a pleasure talking with you. I hope everything works well for everyone. I'm hoping the training in June is still on in Spain, but who knows?
Yeah, well, I am going to start teaching classes online from here. I think that'll be better than not contacting people. So I'll probably do something like once a week, an hour and a half, and it'll be almost like I was there.
Not really, but we'll see. Maybe we'll all just head to Ohio if they let us in.
No problem. I'd be glad to have you all come, but I don't know if they'll let you in. So we can.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's been great. I learned something every time because it's like practice. I feel I need to hear you say those instructions, those explanations over and over till I kind of really get it in my bones. So thank you so much for this. And I hope many more people will get your brilliant teaching.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm a hippie from the old days, but they had the right ideals and the wrong tools. So I spent my life trying to figure out what the tools are. Now I'm trying to give them away. So I very much appreciate your kindness and having me be part of your podcast. Thank you.